Picture this. The roar of the crowd is a distant hum. You're in the tunnel. The lights are blinding.
And the only thing you're focused on is tying your right skate before your left, tapping your stick on the ice 3 times, and taking one deep breath. Every single time.
Is that just a quirky habit, or is it the key that unlocks peak performance?
I get chills just thinking about it. I was a swimmer in college, and I had this whole elaborate stretching routine I had to do behind the starting block. Mm-hmm. If I missed a single step, I was convinced my race was over before it began. I just find it fascinating how these little personal ceremonies feel so...
They feel essential because, in a way, they are. And that's the incredible world we're diving into today, the psychology of sports and tradition. We're going to explore that razor-thin line between a simple superstition and a paperful psychological tool.
Exactly. We'll be looking at how these rituals, customs, and traditions, from an individual athlete's secret handshake to a century-old team chant, can fundamentally shape a player's mindset, tangibly influence their performance, and forge an unbreakable sense of community.
It's about the mental game, the unseen architecture that supports greatness. We're going to unpack why these seemingly strange behaviors aren't just for show. They're a critical part of the playbook.
So, stay with us.
This is going to be a fascinating look at what really goes on inside the mind of an athlete when the pressure's on. I can't wait to get into it.
So let's start there with that feeling of it being essential. I think it comes down to one word, control. In a stadium filled with thousands of screaming fans, with unpredictable opponents, with the weather, with 100 variables you can't manage, that little ritual is your anchor. It's the one sequence of events you have complete and total dominion over.
That's it. That is exactly what it was for me. I couldn't control how fast the girl in the next lane was going to swim, but I could control the precise order of my quad stretch, then my hamstring stretch, then rolling my shoulders 3 times. It was like building a little psychological fortress around myself before the chaos.
A fortress. I love that analogy. It's like you're saying to your own brain, okay, we've done this before. We know this part. The next part, the race, is just an extension of this known safe sequence. It's a trigger, isn't it? It's the mental equivalent of flipping a switch from practice mode to game mode.
Oh, 100%. The smell of the chlorine, the specific squeak of my feet on the wet tile, that final stretch, it was a sensory checklist. Once all the boxes were ticked, my body just knew it was time. But, what happens when you can't tick a box? I mean, that's where it gets a little scary, right?
That's the razor's edge we talked about. It's the difference between a tool and a crutch. A healthy ritual creates focus. An unhealthy superstition creates anxiety. If not tapping your stick 3 times makes you think I might be a little off, that's one thing. If it makes you think I am definitely going to lose now, your powerful tool has just become a weapon pointed squarely at yourself.
Right, because you've just introduced a negative thought, a seed of doubt, into that mental fortress you so carefully built. And at an elite level, a single seed of doubt is all it takes.
Think about a golfer standing over a putt to win a major. Their pre-shot routine is sacrosanct. It's identical every single time. It's designed to quiet the mind, to make this one incredibly high-stakes moment feel just like the 10,000 practice putts they've made before. It's neurological. They're literally trying to fire the same synapses.
So it's not just a mental comfort blanket, it's actual brain science? You're carving a path in your own mind?
You're carving a groove, a deep one, so that when the pressure is immense, your brain doesn't have to think. It just falls into the groove. The routine takes over, and it carries your performance with it. It automates excellence, in a way.
Wow. Automating excellence? But that also explains the panic when the routine gets disrupted. A sudden noise, a delay, it knocks you out of that groove. And suddenly you're not just standing over a putt, you're standing over a putt to win the championship, and your brain is fully, terrifyingly aware of it.
And that's precisely the danger. The moment you're knocked out of that groove, your brain is flooded with what psychologists call cognitive load. Instead of performance being automatic, you're suddenly actively thinking about your grip, your stance, your breathing, all the things the routine was designed to make subconscious.
It's like trying to remember how to walk. If you think about it too much, you'll trip.
Oh, I've seen that happen. I remember a teammate in a relay where her goggles snapped right before we walked out. And the sheer panic in her eyes. It wasn't just about the goggles. It was that her entire pre-race sequence was shattered. The rest of us could feel her anxiety, and it instantly put us all on edge. It was contagious.
It is contagious, and you've just hit on the next layer of this, which is fascinating. We've been talking about these rituals as a sort of personal mental fortress, but what happens when the ritual isn't just one person's?
what happens when it belongs to the whole team.
You mean like a team chant or a pregame huddle?
Exactly that. Or something bigger. Think about the New Zealand All Blacks and the haka. That's not just a guy tapping his stick on the ice. That's a profound, shared cultural performance.
It's a ritual that synchronizes the team, not just physically, but emotionally and psychologically. It creates a single, unified entity.
It's like they're plugging into a shared power source. When you do a team cheer, even a silly one, there's a moment where you're all breathing the same air, shouting the same words you feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bigger than yourself. It's not just my race anymore. It's our race.
That's the magic of it. It transforms individual anxiety into collective power. It serves as a social glue.
An anthropologist, Douglas Foley, studied at Texas High School and their whole Friday Night Lights culture.
He described the football game as a weekly community ritual that, for a few hours, erased all the social divisions, class, race, popularity that existed Monday to Thursday.
So it's not just for the players, it's for the whole town?
For everyone. On Friday night, they weren't the rich kid and the poor kid. They were all just fans of the home team. The ritual creates solidarity.
It's a declaration of shared identity. This is who we are. This is what we do together. It's incredibly powerful.
But does it work in the same way neurologically? Is the haka just a bigger version of the golfer's pre-shot routine? Just carving a bigger groove for this whole team?
In some ways, yes. It's a focusing mechanism. It's a trigger. But it also does something else.
It introduces a concept from performance theory called framing. The ritual creates a frame around the event, separating it from ordinary life.
When the haka begins, you're no longer just on a field. You're on a ceremonial battleground. The stakes feel higher, more meaningful.
Wow. A ceremonial battleground. That changes everything. I have to wonder, is there a point where that becomes performative? Where it's less about the team's internal psychology and more about intimidation or just putting on a show for the cameras?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is that the line is incredibly blurry. A ritual can be for both. The haka is absolutely about intimidation. It's a challenge.
But for the All Blacks themselves, it's also a genuine connection to their heritage and to each other. The power comes from the fact that they believe in it.
If they were just going through the motions, everyone would feel it, the audience, the other team. She didn't. It would be hollow.
So the authenticity is the active ingredient. It has to mean something. It can't just be a routine you're handed on a playbook. It has to come from somewhere real. Which makes me think. What about traditions that get passed down through generations of a team, like, say, touching a sign on the way out of the locker room? The new players don't have a history with it, so how does it become meaningful for them?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? It becomes meaningful through a kind of social inheritance. The new player walks into that locker room, and they see the captain, the veterans, the people they look up to, all touching that sign with reverence.
The meaning isn't in the sign itself. It's transferred to the newcomer through observation and the innate human desire to belong.
So it's a form of social proof? If it matters this much to them, it has to matter to me if I want to be one of them. It's an act of assimilation, really.
Precisely. By performing the ritual, the rookie is non-verbally stating, I accept your history. I want to be a part of your legacy. It's their first real step in shedding their individual identity to become part of the collective.
And that right there is the entire arc we've been talking about, from the personal to the shared.
Wow. Yeah. We started with one athlete alone in a tunnel tying their skates and ended with an entire community, an entire history, being channeled through one simple action, like touching a sign. It's about creating order out of chaos, isn't it? Whether that chaos is inside your own head or in the roar of a stadium.
That's the perfect way to put it. It's all a search for an anchor, a repeatable pattern in an unpredictable world.
It's the story we tell ourselves and each other to make the impossible feel manageable.
I'm completely sold on the power of it, but I guess my one lingering thought is, what about the ones who don't need it? The athletes who seem almost immune to that pressure, who can just walk out cold and perform, are they just wired differently, or have they found a different kind of anchor?
I think that's a fantastic point. And maybe their lack of ritual is their ritual. Their anchor might be a supreme, unwavering self-confidence that doesn't require an external trigger. Or maybe their focus is just so intense it blocks everything else out naturally. It proves there's no single formula for greatness.
Right. The tool is only as good as the person using it. For some, it's a finely crafted psychological scalpel. For others, man, maybe they just don't need it to perform the surgery. And that's a fascinating idea in itself.
It really is. It shows the incredible diversity of the human mind under pressure. From a private superstition to a thundering haka, it's all about finding what works.
What makes you believe in that critical moment that you are ready?
Well, this has been an incredible deep dive. It's given me a whole new appreciation for every little quirk and chant I see on game day. They're not just quirks. They're the architecture of the mental game.
They are indeed. Thank you so much for joining us on this exploration into the psychology of sports and tradition.
It's a reminder that so much of the battle is won or lost before the game even begins.
Absolutely. To everyone listening, thanks for tuning in. We hope it gives you something new to look for the next time you're watching your favorite team. Stay curious, and we'll talk to you next time.